about that seriously. And it cannot be just higher walls and stronger doors and barricaded windows.
Mass shootings at houses of worship are rare, but after the deadly shooting at a Minnesota church last week, many congregations are considering their safety. It's Monday, September 1st, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers. On this Labor Day, we take a look at the largest employer in the country, the federal government. President Trump came into office with a vision to make it smaller and more efficient. Is it working?
We're losing that institutional knowledge. And as much as the current administration thinks everyone is just quickly replaceable, they're not.
Also, there's a new fundraising album of songs for Gaza. It's in Yiddish.
It's something that opens up a space for acknowledging the pain of the other and seeing it in relation to one's own trauma and pain.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. Days after the FDA limited COVID-19 vaccines to those at risk of serious complications, President Trump is now calling on pharmaceutical companies to justify the success of drugs and vaccines used to fight the virus. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
The president questioned the effectiveness of COVID vaccines, saying there's a disagreement over whether or not they are a, quote, miracle that saved millions of lives. His post comes just days after Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an anti-vaccine activist, announced significant limits on who is eligible for the vaccines. Trump himself hailed COVID vaccines as a modern-day miracle back in 2020 during his first term. But now he's demanded drug companies make more information and results public. It's unclear what information he's referring to. NPR reached out to the White House for clarity. In response, spokesperson Kush Desai said, quote, "The only driving principle of health decision-making in this administration is gold standard science." Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
In eastern Afghanistan, at least 800 people are dead and more than 2,500 injured. This after a 6.0 earthquake struck around midnight as people slept and homes collapsed in the Kunar province. Crews are working to find survivors and evacuate the wounded. The BBC's Yogite Lamaya reports rescue efforts are complicated by the remoteness of the mountainous region.
Rescue and relief operations are going to take time. We have on our way here, we did cross a few trucks which seem loaded with supplies that the Taliban government was trying to move towards the area. We know that they are running helicopters at the moment, trying to get to the epicenter because the road to the worst affected villages, that's been cut off because of landslides.
That's the BBC's Yogite Lamaya reporting. Hundreds of news outlets around the world have signed on to an appeal calling for the protection of Palestinian journalists in Gaza and for foreign press to be let in. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports Israeli forces have killed more than 200 Palestinian journalists since the war broke out.
Many of the media outlets signed on are blacking out their front pages or, like NPR, are taking part by reporting on the appeal and the risks Palestinian journalists face in Gaza. A similar petition signed in June by the editors-in-chiefs of major news organizations noted that Israel's ban on independent access to Gaza is without precedent in modern warfare. Moreover, the Committee to Protect Journalists says August was the deadliest month ever recorded for journalists globally. That's due to what Palestinians say is 15 journalists killed in Gaza in August alone. Last week, Israeli attacks killed 5 journalists at a hospital, including photographers for Reuters and the AP. 2 more journalists were killed since then in other attacks. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
This is NPR News. Drug deaths in the U.S. continue a historic decline, according to the latest provisional data from the CDC. NPR's Brian Mann reports fatal overdoses have now reached their lowest level in 5 years.
Fatal drug overdoses rose during the pandemic to catastrophic levels, driven in part, according to public health experts, by the rapid spread of street fentanyl. The latest CDC data shows deaths have now plunged nationwide by roughly a third from the peak. The latest 12-month period through March of this year found a total of roughly 77,648 U.S. drug deaths. A report earlier this year appeared to show drug deaths rising again, but revised federal data now shows fatal overdoses have declined steadily without interruption for 2 years. CDC researchers say revisions are common in complex public health data. Despite this unprecedented decline in drug deaths, President Trump cites fentanyl as justification for a range of policies from tariffs to the crackdown on migrants. Brian Mann, NPR News.
President Trump announced today he's awarding the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Rudy Giuliani. In a statement posted to social media, Trump called his political ally the greatest mayor in the history of New York City and an equally great American patriot. This comes a day after Giuliani was badly injured in a car accident in New Hampshire. In tennis, at a packed Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York this afternoon, four-time Grand Slam champion Naomi Osaka secured her place in the U.S. Open quarterfinals, defeating American third seed Coco Gauff, winner of the French Open. I'm Amy Held in Washington, and this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Visit St. Pete, Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. And now a message paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it. But it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there's 988, with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks want to help you when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers. Since two children were killed at a Catholic church in Minnesota last week, companies that provide security training for houses of worship say they've received a flood of calls. The calls are coming from leaders of churches, mosques, and temples who want to know how they can safeguard their own sanctuaries. Mass shootings at houses of worship remain rare, but security experts say there are some steps that every congregation can and should take. Jack Jenkins of Religion News Service has the story.
When Nick Spencer heard about the shooting that took place at a Catholic church in Minneapolis, he, like millions of Americans, was heartbroken. But as the chief operations officer of the security firm Stratagos International, he also prepared for what he knew would come next.
This is what we've seen time and time again, unfortunately, is that once an event occurs, there's a huge inquiry that happens. People want to know about resources. What can we do to not be the next victim in this situation?
Spencer's company, a Christian business, helps houses of worship develop emergency protocols to step up security to protect against mass shooters and other threats. He says business has expanded as more houses of worship fall victim to mass shootings, such as when a gunman attacked a Sikh temple in 2012 in Wisconsin, or when the Tree of Life Synagogue suffered the worst anti-Semitic attack in American history in Pennsylvania in 2018, or when gunmen opened fire in churches in South Carolina in 2015 and Texas in 2017 and California in 2022. Spencer's group employs security personnel at schools and houses of worship, which he says can provide faster intervention during attacks like the one that unfolded in Minnesota. Some Catholic groups are considering training ushers in security protocols at masses or instituting active shooter drills. Other faith communities are also sharing their expertise. Michael Masters is head of the Jewish nonprofit Secure Community Network, which offers security trainings to a wide variety of religious groups.
I think in respect to other faith-based groups, we are not waiting to get calls. We are making calls.
Masters said that because of violent anti-Semitism, American Jews have developed expertise in how to secure sacred spaces.
The Jewish community has lived with this reality for years. We have made substantive investments in the safety and security of our faith-based institutions in the Jewish community.
Faith leaders say enhanced security isn't the only way to keep worshipers safe. Many houses of worship ban guns on their property, and many religious groups have urged lawmakers to pass gun control legislation. But after years of waiting for help from Washington, religious communities are now turning to private security groups for help, even as they voice rising outrage over the growing death toll.
We need to do something about that seriously, and it's not just for the security experts. It cannot be just higher walls and stronger doors and barricaded windows.
Security measures aren't a guarantee. Even armed officers haven't always stopped mass shooters. But both Masters and Spencer mentioned three of the same security tips for houses of worship. Install security cameras, fortify your doors with locks, and consider covering windows with ballistic film. For NPR News, I'm Jack Jenkins in Washington.
The story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service. House Speaker Mike Johnson was one of the biggest proponents of President Trump's tax and spending bill, which could have major impacts on Medicaid recipients and community health centers in his state of Louisiana. The Gulf States Newsroom's Drew Hawkins reports from Bossier City.
Louisiana is a place where everybody seems to know everybody. Take Jamie Collins. He says he's been living on the street since he lost his job last November, but he's met House Speaker Mike Johnson.
I used to paint his house.
Collins says he painted Johnson's home in Bossier Parish a few years ago. This was before he became House Speaker. Johnson came through and inspected his work, and Collins says he liked the job.
But how can you like a job with a person that performed the work on your house, cutting Medicaid, they're putting him in a bind?
Collins says his work as a painter dried up. Then he found a job at a casino, but was let go when business got slow. But he says he still had Medicaid to help out.
It really did cover everything, from the hospital bills to medication.
He's not alone. In his district, which Speaker Johnson represents, more than a third of the population are on Medicaid, according to KFF, a health policy research group. Statewide, nearly 10% of Louisianans on Medicaid could lose coverage because of work requirements. NPR reached out to House Speaker Mike Johnson to ask for an interview for this story. His office declined to comment. Johnson has been back in his district over the summer recess defending the changes to Medicaid work requirements as a way to reduce waste and fraud, like here at a press conference in Bossier City last month.
There's a lot of misconceptions. This idea about how we're cutting Medicaid and people are going to lose their health coverage is just simply not true.
Across town, David Jackson is sitting on his porch because his home doesn't have AC and it's cooler outside. He's looking for a new job. He says the landscaping gig he left wasn't paying enough to cover his expenses.
You know, every time I try to make a penny, I got to up a nickel.
Like Collins, he relies on Medicaid, and his 7-year-old son goes to the David Raines Community Health Center, which has clinics all throughout Johnson's district. Jackson's son has a speech impediment. It's much easier for him to get to the clinic because it's at his school.
They have helped me to get him to talk in and, you know, sending me to extra centers and things like that there. And, you know, they are very helpful.
David Raines is a federally qualified health center, also known as a community health center in Bossier City. It relies heavily on Medicaid reimbursements.
We're about 65-67% of our patients are on Medicaid.
Willie White is CEO at David Raines. We're at a clinic in Bossier High School. He says the Medicaid cuts set to be phased in over the next 10 years will affect the entire organization, from clinics like these to dental services and pharmacies. Joining him is Joe Dunn with the National Association of Community Health Centers. He says even though some of the changes won't kick in for over a year, clinics like these are already preparing for a crisis.
Right now, a lot of health centers are having financial troubles, and so about 40% are with less than 90 days cash on hand.
Dunn says they need more federal funding to make up for the $7 billion they're projecting to lose because of Medicaid cuts. He says they're asking Congress for an additional $1.2 billion when they take a look at funding for community health centers, set to expire at the end of next month. Without that extra money,
it certainly could lead to closures and loss of staff and things like that.
The chair of the committee that deals with community health centers like these is Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican from Louisiana. In a statement to NPR, Cassidy's office says he's committed to reauthorizing funding for community health centers on time and in a, quote, fiscally responsible manner. But his office did not indicate whether they would support additional funding. And without that extra money from Congress, Dunn warns nearly a quarter of these health centers across the country could shut down or reduce services in the next 2 years. For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in Bossier City, Louisiana.
People have been responding to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza in many ways, some by donating money to humanitarian projects, others by protesting. Earlier this month, a fundraising album of songs for Gaza was released in Yiddish, a language nearly eradicated by genocide. Dina Preshep reports.
After October 7th, Joe Dobkin, a New York artist, was reading the news, and he saw a video of an Israeli soldier on a tank rolling into Gaza, singing an old Yiddish song.
And the song was Zugnit Kainmol, which is an anthem of partisan resistance to the Nazis. And this is while all day, every day, I'm watching images of people being bombed to death.
Dobkin is the grandchild of Holocaust survivors and descendant of people who didn't survive. So he wanted to respond in Yiddish, speaking out about what he saw as a genocide in this language that was almost destroyed by one. So he wrote a song. The lyrics say there is no safety through oppression, that the past should not become a prison. It needs to be a tool of liberation.
For every generation that comes to Yiddish, there is this feeling of urgency, a feeling of responsibility because of the violent ruptures of the 20th century.
Madeleine Cohen directs educational programs at the Yiddish Book Center and teaches Jewish studies at Mount Holyoke College. She says because of genocide, displacement, and assimilation, outside of Orthodox Judaism, a surprisingly small number of Jews grow up speaking Yiddish. So those who choose Yiddish feel the weight of its story and can see parallels. Like Yiddish musician and ethnomusicologist Isabel Fry.
Singing in Yiddish about what is happening in Gaza is automatically putting into relation the Holocaust and whatever is happening there. It's something that opens up a space for acknowledging the pain of the other and seeing it in relation to one's own trauma and pain. And I think that's actually something very powerful.
Fry, along with artist Joe Dobkin, helped create the album Lieder mit Palestina, Songs for Palestine. It features 17 original compositions from different musicians, some modern, some mournful, some that can break your heart, and all shaped by Yiddish and its history. Like this poem by Sholem Berger, sung by Esther Gottesman.
Their hunger is not our bread, and their death will not revive the dead.
Fry also translates this song by Josh Waletsky.
And it's based on this Yiddish idiom. The person that digs a grave for the others, it falls in themselves. We're standing at the crossroads between humanity and the abyss. And it's tearing out a piece of my heart. I mean, that's how I've been feeling every day.
To build the world of Yiddish culture is to work in the shadow of loss and destruction, and also music and joy. The Yiddish community, like pretty much every Jewish community, has been torn by what's happened on and since October 7th. But the musicians on Lieder mit Palestina are hoping that they can use this old language to bring a new perspective. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. KXE has built connections between listeners, community organizations, and local businesses in northern Minnesota since 1976. Consider becoming a business or community sponsor to help KAXE build strong connections now and into the future. Text the word sponsor to 218-326-1234. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
On this date, September 1st, 1999, I noted what I hoped were the last of the horseflies. Horseflies are large, brown, biting flies that have jaws that work like two knives slicing back and forth, sort of perpendicular to their body alignment, and those slicing mouth parts cut open your skin, and then the fly proceeds to lap up the blood. Now, she needs the blood as a means of making her eggs. She needs the protein from the blood to make the eggs that are going to be next year's horseflies. And so I hate to give them any of my blood, if at all possible. And this late in September marks what I always hope for as the last of the horseflies.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Arm. On the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO and host Renee Haas talks to musician and activist Peter Gabriel about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future in creativity and innovations. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers. Movie theaters have been overrun all summer by dinosaurs, dragons, aliens, Formula One racers, and superheroes. In other words, it's blockbuster season. But as the weather cools, Hollywood's vibe will change, says critic Bob Mondello. He's here with his fall movie preview.
4 months left in 2025 and not a superhero in sight, what on earth will the film industry do?
I would like you to meet Ares, the ultimate soldier.
The same thing college students do with their term papers, turn to AI.
He's biblically strong, lightning fast, supremely intelligent. And if he is struck down on the battlefield, I will simply make you another.
What could possibly go wrong? Tron Ares flips the script from the previous Tron films by bringing virtual beings into our world rather than plugging people into a computer grid. Other dark visions of the future include two from Stephen King, The Running Man, about a TV reality show.
The rules are simple. Survive 30 days, the entire nation hunting you down.
And The Long Walk, King's very first novel, written when he was 19, with a contest that's eerily similar.
I'm not going to go through the whole rule book, but it boils down to this.
Walk or die.
There's one winner and no finish line.
Happily, most fall films are based in the real world. In fact, more than a few are biopics. Richard Linklater's made two, one about Broadway's Lorenz Hart, the lyric writing half of Rodgers and Hart.
Wise guy.
Alas, Blue Moon finds Hart nursing his sorrows at the opening night party for Oklahoma, the first Rodgers and Hammerstein musical.
We write together for a quarter of a century, and the first show he writes with someone else is going to be the biggest hit he ever had. Am I bitter?
Larry?
Yes.
Linklater's other biopic is Nouvelle Vague, about French New Wave director Jean-Luc Godard.
Nouvelle Vague, un film de cinéma.
Also about filmmaking, the comedy Waltzing with Brando.
For justice, we must go to Don Corleone.
Starring Billy Zane as a troublemaking Marlon Brando.
Well, why didn't you go to the police? Why didn't you come to me first?
Cut. Elsewhere, Dwayne The Rock Johnson stars as the popular martial arts fighter known as the Smashing Machine.
Please welcome in his octagon debut, Mark Cutts!
In Nuremberg, Russell Crowe plays Hitler confidant Hermann Göring.
I will have, as you say, my day in court.
Opposite Rami Malek.
I know more about this man than anyone else on the planet.
Who plays an American Army psychiatrist trying to assess whether Göring's fit to stand trial. And in the season's big music biopic, Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere. The Bears' Jeremy Allen White plays the boss and does his own singing. Along with those dramatic recreations, there are documentaries, Riefenstahl, about Nazi propagandist Leni Riefenstahl, Stiller and Mira, Nothing is Lost, which is Ben Stiller's homage to his comedy team parents, and Orwell, 2 + 2 = 5, about British author George Orwell, who wrote Animal Farm and 1984.
The very concept of objective truth is fading out of this world. This prospect frightens me much more than bombs.
Too much reality? Well, some heavyweight directors have crafted entertainments that sound like potential Oscar bait.
Jay. Kelly. And action.
Noah Baumbach's coming of middle age dramedy stars Jay. George Clooney as a movie star.
Jay Kelly is a hero of cinema.
He is in his 60s. He's suave, relaxed, always seems to be playing himself.
You know how difficult it is to be yourself? You try it.
He is, in short, a lot like George Clooney.
We love him.
You love him. I work for him.
There will be blood. Director Paul Thomas Anderson is working in IMAX for the first time with his comedy One Battle After Another.
World War III out there! Viva la revolution!
Call Me By Your Name director Luca Guadagnino tackles a Me Too story in After the Hunt.
Hank walked me home. He asked for a nightcap, which, you know, it's fine. He's Hank. Everybody loves Hank.
What are you saying happened?
Grad student Ayo Edebiri accuses college professor Andrew Garfield, and Julia Roberts gets caught in the middle.
I don't feel comfortable having this conversation with you anymore.
Not everything is supposed to make you comfortable.
Dreamgirls director Bill Condon's latest is Kiss of the Spider-Woman, with Jennifer Lopez as the title character.
Spider-Woman.
While Catherine Bigelow, who won Oscar's Diffusing Bombs in The Hurt Locker, upgrades to stopping a missile launch in A House of Dynamite, Oscar winner Guillermo del Toro is tackling Frankenstein.
What manner of creature is that?
And in Bugonia, Yorgos Lanthimos reunites with his Poor Things star, Emma Stone, for a story of two kidnappers who think a business exec is otherworldly.
How can you tell she's an alien?
Well, the signs are obvious.
First-time directors include Scarlett Johansson, who's made Eleanor the Great with June Squibb.
I'm 94 years old, and I'm moving to Manhattan for the first time today.
And Ronan Day-Lewis, who's coaxed his father, Daniel Day-Lewis, out of retirement for the Irish drama Anemone.
What do you want from me, brother? What do you want?
As for the football horror flick, Him, the director is perhaps less important to audiences than the producer, Jordan Peele.
Now we're playing some football!
Fall is also a time for romance. The aching gay love story, The History of Sound, makes soulmates of music students Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor.
If I had what you had, I'd leave. I go far away, flee.
While comic love stories include a big, bold, beautiful journey that starts in the real world, then gives reality a tweak.
Remain on Interstate for 249 miles. David? David?
Sorry, are we talking to each other now?
Do you want to go on a big, bold, beautiful journey?
Yes.
His GPS then teams Colin Farrell with a skeptical Margot Robbie.
Your accent, is it real?
You think I fake an accent?
The most beautiful places make you feel the most alone.
That's a pretty good me, actually. I'm flattered.
And while they get to live their dream, in the Choose Your Partner for the Afterlife comedy, Eternity, Elizabeth Olsen gets to die hers.
It's not a competition.
With both of her dead husbands.
Yes, he is.
Sweetheart, it is 100% for sure a competition.
It is, in fact, a competition.
That's literally what we're here for.
Those are angels advising her. And in the comedy Good Fortune, another angel, Keanu Reeves, tries to even the score between unfortunate assistant Aziz Ansari and very fortunate boss Seth Rogen.
I'm not really supposed to be doing this. I'm normally only in charge of saving people from texting and driving.
Wait, you're telling me I have a budget guardian angel?
Kinda.
Other comedies include the reunion tour of the greatest band that never was in Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues.
We're still short a drummer.
What happened to him?
Yeah. He sneezed himself into oblivion.
Is that medically possible?
Roofman, a caper comedy in which Channing Tatum's title character...
Still no leads on the whereabouts of the escaped convict known as the Roofman.
...cannot share his backstory with Kirsten Dunst. And then there's the magician heist flick sequel called Now You See Me, Now You Don't.
I'm talking about a trick that is bigger and better than anything you have ever seen.
Jesse Eisenberg welcoming new illusionists.
According to that card, for some reason, I need you.
Why not the other horsemen?
The other horsemen are dead.
Oh my God, what?
No, they're like dead to me. Things got too real for them. They gave up. Stop interrupting.
Other sure things include an apparent end to a bustling saga that seemed destined to go on forever, Downton Abbey, the grand finale.
It's hard to accept. But it's time to go.
And after the longest intermission in musical comedy history...
Elva Withrop, I know you're out here. Just come in before the monkeys spot you.
The second act of Wicked. I've heard it said... Composer Stephen Schwartz wrote two new songs to make Wicked for Good worth the wait, and it needs to be in a season this crowded.
Bring me the broom of the Wicked Witch of the West.
I'm Bob Mandel.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It is 4:29 on this Labor Day, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is Saturday, September 6th in the Lions Club building at Olcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era. The Clearwater County History Center in Shevlin invites you to an open house for National Grandparents Day, Sunday, September 7th, from 1 to 4. Enjoy a car show, wagon rides, and refreshments. You can even make your own ice cream. The Metza Garden in Virginia has a fall plant sale and produce swap Friday, September 5th, from 8 to 1. The garden is located on Bailey Lake on 3rd Street North. Now for National Native News here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Summer is prime time for gathering and baking camas across the Pacific Northwest, Rockies, and Plains regions. Native people usually harvest, then bake, the plant's bulbs as part of their first foods menu. As Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports, there was even a bake-off held outside Eugene, Oregon.
Salette's tribal member Joe Scott heads the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program under the Long Tom Watershed Council. He described how he'd layer his packets of leaf-wrapped camas bulbs.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw the wet sword ferns on top of this. Bunch of water, like a couple of buckets of water after the maple leaves. And then a layer of these skunk cabbage leaves, put the packets on top of that. And then the alder and the ferns and all this stuff right here.
Oh, and there's mugwort, hazel, and bracken ferns in Scott's recipe, too. The whole oven hissed with steam once the water hit the hot rocks. Nearby, the TEIP senior intern and my kid, Samuel Bull of the Nez Perce tribe, assembled the second oven with Mom's help. This was mostly ferns, maple leaves, and camas bumbled in skunk cabbage leaves, with some carrots and potatoes thrown in for experimentation's sake, all under canvas and four buckets of water.
Yes, I would put the camas closer to the middle. Okay. Get those to go.
Right there is great.
Is it cooking?
Yeah.
Flash forward to a day later. Bull decided to do a camas bake for 24 hours. The group peeled back the canvas to reveal glistening and translucent camas bulbs.
Looks good.
Oh, look at those beauties.
Good?
It's really good.
Give me some flavor notes.
Really soft, sweet, and starchy. Perfect.
I'm so happy.
Wow.
And yes, Bull's potatoes and carrots came out well, too. Scott's batch baked for nearly 26 hours and had a small fire burning atop his oven for part of that time. At first, there was a little concern as some bulbs were hardened and dark, but then when the rest were unearthed,
they're perfect. They're like a sweet gumdrop.
The longer bake meant Scott's camas were more caramelized and sweeter. But at the end of the day, Scott said the real success of the event was creating community. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull, near Eugene, Oregon.
A new food spot is now open at the Albuquerque, New Mexico airport, featuring Native foods. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
First opening its doors in 1976, the restaurant was reimagined in 2020.
Every Pueblo has a different style of what they cook, what they make.
Chef Josh Aragon is from the Laguna Pueblo and heads the kitchen at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center on tribal land in the heart of Albuquerque.
It's just a combination of all the Pueblos put together, all 19, as a matter of fact. And what comes out of the food is the smiles, the thoughts, the full bellies.
From fry bread and enchiladas to daily hand-baked goods like Pueblo pies, tortillas, and lots of loaves of bread.
Yesterday I did three batches, so about 104. Plus 240 dough balls.
Rita Toledo is the head baker and now has to prepare even more fresh dishes to feed hungry customers at Albuquerque International Sunport.
The bread we bake, somebody's going to take somewhere out of state. That's exciting.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Skugdash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Dom Yen.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing the number 27-MEDICARE. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers. On this Labor Day, we're looking at the largest employer in the country, the federal government. President Trump came into office vowing to shrink the government and make it more efficient. So far, it's clear he's achieved part of that. The government is smaller. But whether it's working better remains up for debate. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
Since January, the Trump administration has moved with stunning speed to shrink the federal workforce, firing tens of thousands of employees, offering buyouts to nearly everyone else, suggesting they could be more productive elsewhere. Here was President Trump at a cabinet meeting last week.
We've reduced the number of federal bureaucrats by 84,000.
And many more will be off the payroll very soon. The Office of Personnel Management reports the government is on track to shed about 300,000 employees this year, about 1 in 8 federal workers out by the end of December, most of them voluntary. OPM's director Scott Cooper told CNBC there's a lot of opportunity in this moment.
We've got great people. It's just a question of the system they're working in just doesn't reward efficiency. It rewards more headcount, more spending. Things only go in one direction here in Washington, and part of the challenge we have is we've got to change that.
But Anthony Lee says the way the Trump administration is going about this is wrong. He says they're driving good people out. Lee's worked at the Food and Drug Administration for more than 2 decades and leads the union representing FDA employees across the Mid-Atlantic. He says the government is losing chemists, toxicologists, engineers, people who make sure drugs and medical devices are safe and effective, who make sure food ingredients aren't poisonous.
It is already, in my view, harming the public because we're losing that institutional knowledge. And as much as the current administration thinks everyone is just quickly replaceable, they're not.
Lee says morale is down for those who remain. Employees have lost colleagues to mass layoffs. They're being stripped of their collective bargaining rights. And Trump demanded everyone work from the office full time, even those hired during the pandemic who don't live close to an office.
Although they came to the federal government because of their passion for public service, they also came because of the flexibility of the government. Those flexibilities are just being wiped away.
With 300,000 workers soon gone, the Office of Personnel Management told NPR it does not expect additional RIFs, reductions in force, for now. But fear still permeates many workplaces.
I fear that I could be RIFed because of my tenure.
This is Julie, who's worked in a lab at a VA hospital in Southern California for about 2 decades. NPR agreed to use only her middle name because she fears reprisal from the VA for speaking out. Julie comes from a military family and is proud of the time she spent at the VA.
In a way, I feel like I have fulfilled what my parents wanted me to do by serving the veterans.
She finds the work meaningful. She likes playing a role in diagnosing and treating veterans' illnesses. Like so many federal workers, she thought she'd retire from this job, and she still hopes to.
I mean, I never thought of going anywhere else. I'm happy with my work.
But her sense of stability has been shattered. Raymond Limon says he never saw this kind of upheaval in his 3 decades in government. He retired in February. As an employment attorney and a human resources leader, Limon spent most of his career ensuring that the federal government has the right people in place.
You know, the federal employee, they take an oath of office, and their loyalty, their fidelity, is to the entire American people.
But now, he says, that's under threat. Limon worries that Trump is politicizing the civil service by firing people whose work he finds objectionable. Justice Department attorneys involved in January 6 prosecutions, Limon's former colleague on the board that reviews federal workers' personnel matters, like wrongful terminations, the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics after a not-so-great jobs report, even inspectors general who are tasked with doing exactly what Trump says he wants done, rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse.
Authoritarianism 101, you know, is number one, go after the watchdogs.
And without watchdogs, Limon wonders, how will Americans, all Americans, be able to trust that their government is not just smaller, but that it's working for them? Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Patrick Furlong. When Furlong was around 13 years old, his parents got divorced and his dad moved out of state. One day when Furlong was a freshman in high school, he was getting ready for a formal school event that required a tie, but he realized he had no idea how to knot it and there was no one at home who could show him.
There were just these like tears of frustration that started to bubble up in my eyes. And I think they represented so much of the pain and hurt I was feeling in my life at that time. So I took the tie and I think I shoved it in like a suit coat pocket. And as I was waiting to get into the event, I think a guidance counselor saw me and he asked, you know, if I could come help him with something. And when we got out of earshot, he just asked me if I had my tie. And I'll never forget the loving, gentle smile he gave me as he tied it for me. And I think all he told me was like, we're going to be okay. And we were. Many, many years later, I'm living in LA with my family and my son is preparing for his first communion. And my son kind of calls for me in the bathroom and asks if I could come and help him tie his tie. And I'm starting to put the tie on. And as I look in the mirror, I just have this moment where I'm taken back to that bathroom. Whereas in high school, I can see like the green wallpaper. I can see the lights that were above the mirror. It's like I'm back in that bathroom. And I'm realizing how powerful it is that I was so alone in that moment, that I didn't have a father to help me tie the tie. And that all these years later, I'm getting to do that simple act for my child, that I'm getting to put the tie on him that my dad wasn't there to be able to put on for me. And later that night, I'm reflecting on that moment. And I'm reflecting on the love of Mr. Archibek. And I had this like vision, almost this kind of prayer that felt really imaginative, where I was back in the bathroom with my son earlier in the day. And I'm standing in that same position, lovingly putting his tie on. And I could picture that like Mr. Archibek was standing behind me. And that he had like his hand on my shoulder. And I'm just looking into my kid's eyes, and then I'm glancing into Mr. Archibek's eyes, who are just smiling at me in that same loving way and telling me we're going to be all right. And it was just this really pivotal moment in my life, and I realized that I don't know that I ever got to thank him for that. So if you're out there, Mr. Archibek, thank you. You have no idea what it meant.
Patrick Furlong lives in Los Angeles, California. He's now an educator himself at Loyola Marymount University. It's a career choice, he says, that was partly inspired by his unsung hero, Clyde Archibek. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Support for KAXE comes from The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit, a two-day gathering to explore belonging, workforce inclusion, environmental justice, and more. Taking place at the Geechee Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd, September 22nd and 23rd. Registration available at sewingroom.org. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers.
Registration is now open for the Itasca Orchestra Youth Strings Program. Classes begin September 15th. Learn more and register at itascaorchestra.org. Now for North Star Stories.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
a special election will fill the seat vacated by the former DFL leader. Then, how a Twin City nonprofit serving vulnerable communities is navigating federal cuts. And community organizations come together to help those in northern Minnesota. I'm Gracie J. The governor has called a special election for House District 34B, which covers parts of Brooklyn Park, Champlain, and Coon Rapids in the Twin Cities area. The seat has been vacant since the tragic deaths of former DFL leader Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark, who were killed in a targeted political attack. Voters will head to the polls on Tuesday, September 16th. Because the timeline is short, election officials recommend dropping your ballot off in person. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. on September 16th. You can pre-register by September 9th or register at the polls on Election Day. After losing most of its federal funding, the Center for Victims of Torture has scaled back its work around the globe. In St. Paul, its healing center remains open, but the people it serves are facing new barriers to stability and healing. Zan Holston has more.
Imagine you are undergoing surgery in an operating room.
Neil Porter is Director of International Services at the Center for Victims of Torture, or CVT, a Minnesota-based global leader in mental health care for victims of torture around the world.
Now imagine, mid-surgery and without explanation, the surgeon and her team are ordered to leave the operating room, unable to return, leaving you stranded, alone, exposed, and unhealed.
Porter is describing what he said started happening to CVT earlier this year when sweeping executive orders from President Trump cut its funding by 75% and demanded it stop its overseas operations. The order slashed CVT's budget from $38 million to $11 million, forcing mass layoffs.
We've laid off more than 400 people globally, including 25 here in Minnesota.
In May, CVT sued the Trump administration, arguing it was unconstitutional for it to withhold funding that had already been approved by Congress. But those cuts were finalized in July when Congress approved a rescission package that legally slashed $9 billion from programs like the U.S. Agency for International Development, a major funding source for CVT. CVT is still fighting that decision in court, but the damage has already been done. Hundreds of staff gone, and programs around the world shut down almost overnight. CVT's international programs have been hit the hardest, but its healing center in St. Paul is also feeling the strain. Jill Davidson is social services lead there.
Torture is an experience that really isolates people.
The healing center provides social and mental health support for survivors of torture, many of whom are seeking asylum in the U.S. Davidson said one of the most important first steps is establishing trust with clients.
To be consistent, to be reliable, to tell people what they can expect, and to follow through.
But increasingly aggressive immigration enforcement is disrupting that consistency.
You understand we're out with immigration, okay? We have a warrant for your arrest, right?
Davidson said many clients are afraid to come to the center or even leave their homes to go to work, leading to more isolation.
We have seen a huge increase in mental health symptoms, and many of the people who had shown great progress in their recovery have regressed within an extremely short period of time.
New rules and increased fees for asylum seekers are also sowing confusion, making the path toward citizenship even more challenging. Asylum seekers, many of whom arrive in the U.S. with little to nothing, must pay for an attorney, then wait 5 months before they can even apply for a work permit. Previously free, that application now costs hundreds of dollars.
They're depending on people in their community for everything they need because they have no way to make their own money.
Davidson said the rules punish the very people who need help the most, forcing them deeper into fear and instability.
I do wonder what our American values are when we treat newcomers this way.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Residents of northern Minnesota who are struggling financially are getting access to some extra help next week. Local agencies and nonprofits are coming together to host the first ever Community Connect event in Ely on Tuesday, September 9th. The free event includes a meal, free hygiene items, and housing support, as well as resources for older adults and families. Arrowhead Transit is providing free rides to and from the event on existing bus routes. The event is taking place at the Ely Area Community Hub from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. next Tuesday.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The new novel, Buckeye, opens with an unplanned kiss. It's also a forbidden kiss between a man and a woman who are married, not to each other. What follows from that kiss will shape the rest of their lives and their families for generations. The author is Patrick Ryan, and he is with me now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're so delighted to have you with us. I want to start by letting you sketch out the backdrop for that kiss. Where does it happen, and what is happening in the world that day?
What is happening in the world the day of the kiss is that the news of the Allied victory in Europe during World War II has just made it onto the radio, and two strangers meet. And the way I got there was because I found out several years ago that my grandmother had a secret that absolutely shocked me. And she had grown up in a small town in Ohio and lived there her entire life. And the secret was that she had maintained an affair for decades with somebody in this town. And it was completely out of line with the way my entire grasp of her as a person. And it got me thinking about what it would take to maintain a major secret for a long time, and what such a secret would do to the two families that it affected. And then I spent about 8 years writing the book and getting to know the characters pretty well.
Yeah.
What I started to do, I think, was get a little obsessed with the idea of what goes into a secret and how a secret itself is pretty simple. You know, it can just be a mistake, and we all make mistakes, but the power in the secret comes from the lies that go into maintaining it, and some of those lies that we have to tell to ourselves over and over again.
That's so fascinating, and you saw that unfolding, it sounds like, in your own family, the original inspiration for this, where your grandmother had a whopper of a secret and kept it a long time. Before we move on from the fictional kiss that you open this novel with, I love the idea that you started it on this pivotal day in history where the whole world was realigning. The world was changing, and the door that opens to something unexpected happening in one person's life, or two, as as the case may be here.
Yes. Yeah. And then just when I started to, with the one character, and I had no interest in writing about my grandmother, I should say, but I was very interested in writing about this situation as a starting point. And the character who is the woman who walks into this hardware store where this kiss takes place in this small town is a beautiful young woman who comes from nothing and has stepped into something of an ideal life that she has a very hard time being satisfied with, and ends up in a kind of a love triangle with one man who is available and right in front of her, and one man who is off at war. And so it led me to the idea of forgiveness, which is a really important theme for me, because I find forgiveness to be so important to any relationships that grown-ups have, and so difficult, such an uphill road. And in the way that a lie becomes a whole lot of secrets, I think forgiveness is not just a single act, but it's a whole lot of decisions, and it can be a million decisions a day that have to be remade over and over.
Yeah. There are a lot of big secrets that your characters keep from each other over years and years and years, and you show us how the lies told to protect the secrets end up doing more damage than the original sins. I wrote down and underlined a line where you pose the question, when is the best time exactly to correct a lie told for 15 years and to reveal the truth that's been buried for 23? Patrick Ryan, yeah. When is the best time? Did you find an answer to that question?
Well, One of the answers that I got was that buried secrets don't want to stay buried forever, and time seems to water them, and they sprout to the surface. And this is where I started to dive in and pick apart forgiveness, because I realized, well, if you let time go by, then what are you asking for forgiveness for? You're asking for forgiveness of the act and then forgiveness of the cover-up. And I think that one of the greatest challenges of that is that if we can't forgive somebody for making a mistake and then taking a while to get around to owning up to it, then we are sort of operating on a falsehood that people are only defined by their good deeds in life. And I really believe that people are also very much defined by what they do with their mistakes.
It's interesting because you are writing, whether it's that kiss and everything that flowed from it or other things, you're writing about people doing things they absolutely know they should not be doing, things that they may well regret, and you do still manage to find goodness in them. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's important to me. I believe as a writer that the best way to write a villain is to realize that villains don't think of themselves as villains. And so to just back that up a bit or soften it a bit, the best way to write people doing unfortunate or unpleasant things or things that would just make a reader cringe is to incorporate into the act of doing it their reason for doing it, because everyone has a reason for doing whatever they're doing in the moment they're doing it, even if it's ridiculous or illogical. And it was really important to me to, by the time the action occurs, that the reader has come with that character so that they have a chance to understand why this is happening from the perspective of the person doing it.
Yeah, I found myself switching allegiances in terms of who I was rooting for as the book unfolded.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, really?
A little bit, yeah.
It's fascinating. You have written fiction before along the way, but this is your first adult novel and you are publishing it at the age of 60. So first of all, wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
Is there a lesson here beyond the obvious, just keep plugging, never give up?
Gosh, that was going to be my lesson answer. I do feel like stick-to-itiveness is the only reason that I'm here. And I think the lesson is, if you're writing, to remind yourself that you're writing, number one, you're writing because you enjoy it and because you want to see what happens as you write. I have on a little piece of paper taped to the wall next to my desk, a little piece of paper that says, "No one asked you to write." And it's in my handwriting. And it's just me talking to me as a little reminder that the reason I'm doing this is because I'm electing to do it.
Well, I'm so glad you did. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you. Thank you for reading and for all of these great questions.
Patrick Ryan talking about his novel, Buckeye.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, E9.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde. Available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. United Way of 1000 Lakes hosts the Lumberjack Mile and 5K Saturday, September 6th. Registration at 8 a.m., race at 9 a.m. at